We got up to slide 13, which I haven't talked about yet, but obviously this is a graph. The x-axis is time. It's labeled as progress of the reaction, but that's time. And the y-axis is free energy, which is G, right? So any individual point on here, the y value of that would be the instantaneous value of the free energy, which is G. And before I talk more about the graph, what kind of reaction is this? How would you classify this based on energy? Exergonic. Right, it's exergonic because you end up with a lower G than you started with. In other words, delta G is negative, so that's exergonic. Energy is released by this reaction. The reaction is a system. That's not the major point of it, though. That's just review. And also, the details really aren't important. You've seen a rearrangement of bonds like you do in any reaction, but A and B, C and D are just generic atoms that are parts of molecules. The point here is that in any given reaction, reactant turns into product, and therefore you change the stuff you have, but that doesn't happen just instantaneously. In any given reaction, to get from reactants to products, certain chemical bonds need to be broken, new chemical bonds need to be formed in order to make that new stuff. And that actually involves going through what is called a transition state, represented by A and B still kind of connected together, but the squiggly line between them indicates that that bond is in the process of being broken. So the transition state is neither reactant nor product. It's somewhere in between. And that's a very unstable situation. Remember that last time when we talked about G originally, I said that high values of G correspond to instability, right? Which is why things happen on their own in such a way that stability increases. G gets lower. That's why you fall downward, not upward. That's why the diffusion happens down the gradient, and so on. So the transition state is very highly unstable. It has the higher G than either the reactants or the products. And that's the really important point about this. Now, this is an exergonic reaction, but you could draw a corresponding graph for an endergonic reaction. It would just start out with lower G than it ends up with. But the point is that the transition state that it has to get through to go from reactant to product has a higher G value than either of the other two. Okay, whether it's endergonic or exergonic. And so that transition state with its high G represents an energetic hill that has to be climbed in order for this reaction to occur. The fact that this is an exergonic, this one that we're looking at on the slide, means that you should expect this to be spontaneous, right? Meaning that it can occur on its own. But like I said last time, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to anytime soon. This explains why. Because even a spontaneous reaction has to get over this transition state with higher G. And if the available thermal energy in the system isn't enough, then it's not going to anytime soon. All right? The transition state has to be reached. Well, however higher the transition state is than the reactants, as you see here, this vertical distance here, gets its special name. It's called the energy of activation, or E sub A, or activation energy. They all really refer to the same thing. And by looking at this graphically, hopefully you can see that the activation energy is not at all part of or involved with delta G. Delta G depends only on the beginning and ending G values, not on anything you do between those. Okay? Delta G graphically is simply the difference in Y values between ending and beginning. And that has nothing to do with this hill that has to be gotten over. The hill that has to be gotten over is activation energy. Okay, well, in 14, we see exactly the same graph for the black trace. That's the one we just looked at. It's the same reaction. The red trace is superimposed on this, though. The red trace is this same reaction occurring with the help of an enzyme, whereas the black one, the original one, is without the help of an enzyme. We keep talking about enzymes. They are catalysts, right? Proteins that act as catalysts. Catalysts speed up reactions millions of times faster. This shows you energetically why that happens. Enzymes operate specifically, meaning that they work only for a specific substrate, which is part of a specific reaction. And they help out by accelerating in different ways depending on the specific enzyme. But all enzymes operate by reducing E sub A. They reduce the activation energy. They can do that in different ways depending on the specific enzyme, but all enzymes accomplish a reduction in the value of E sub A. They make that hill not as hard to climb. They make it not as high. And therefore, if it gets low enough, that explains why the reaction can proceed so much faster, because the thermal energy available in the system will be enough to get over that shorter hill. But, corresponding with what I said in the previous slide, notice that what an enzyme does by affecting that E sub A has no effect at all on delta G. An enzyme never changes the value of delta G. Delta G is defined entirely by beginning and ending G values. The hill is something happening in between the activation energy. And that is the only thing that the enzyme affects. All right, let's go to 15. Look at an enzyme. This is a space-filling model of an enzyme. You can see that it's a complex molecule with a complex shape. And in any given enzyme, there is a part of the surface called the active site. We've talked about this before. The active site is the business end of the enzyme because that's the specific place where the substrate binds. And substrate, recall, simply refers to the reactant in a catalyzed reaction. So substrate and reactant are the same thing. It's just we call the reactant substrate because it's a catalyzed reaction. It's helped out by an enzyme, and therefore there's going to be a temporary binding of that substrate to the enzyme. This is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? And all enzymes are proteins. Substrate is an example of a ligand because it's something binding to a protein. And you should be automatic now in what you consider to be the general consequence of that, right? When a ligand binds to a protein, what happens? There is a conformational change in the protein, in this case the enzyme. Well, there's already a pretty good fit between the shape of the substrate and the shape of the enzyme. That's why the enzyme is specific for that reaction. It recognizes that substrate, not others. Already a pretty good shape, like a key in a lock. But what we see in this picture is that when the binding of the substrate at the active site of the enzyme happens, there's going to be a shape change in that enzyme, and the fit gets even better because of that change in conformation. This is called induced fit. To induce means to bring about. So there is an even better fit between substrate and enzyme that is induced by the original binding of that substrate to the enzyme. And it's kind of like a handshake. Right? You can get someone who just gives you the hand and that's it. Makes no further effort. That's a handshake. But then there's the firm handshakers where they will wrap their hand around yours and really grab on. That's what induced fit is like. And it's caused by the binding of the substrate to the enzyme. But it, the nice thing about it is that it, since it's an even better fit, there's even more isolation of the substrate from the surroundings, which makes it a more ideal environment for that reaction to occur. And how that reaction occur, meaning how that enzyme operates, depends on the specific enzyme. For instance, if it's a catabolic reaction, something's being broken into smaller pieces, then the binding of the substrate to the enzyme might stress the bonds so that they can more easily break. Or if it's an anabolic enzyme, maybe the enzyme brings in two substrates in just the right orientation with each other so that they can easily bond. Without the help of the enzyme, they would just be bouncing off of each other and they wouldn't necessarily be in the right orientation with respect to each other. So there's different ways enzymes work, but they all lower activation energy and therefore speed up the reaction. 16 is a cyclic picture showing the cyclic nature, the reusability, in other words, of enzymes. Since enzymes aren't reactants, they don't get changed into anything. They will change shape when substrate binds to them, but they'll change back into their original shape, unbound shape, after the substrate turns into product and gets released from the enzyme. The enzyme will resume its original shape and therefore be reusable for another round as long as you have more substrate. They are reusable. And this is an important point about enzymes. As long as they exist, and as long as there are substrate available, they'll continue to work. Well, sometimes a cell would like that reaction to no longer be happening. Therefore, enzymes either need, if they're no longer needed, if you don't want them to continue to allow the reaction to occur, the cell either has to destroy the enzyme, that will obviously turn it off, right? Or temporarily turn it off. And this is an important part of phosphorylation. When we talked about functional groups originally in that chapter, I told you many important things about the phosphate group. One of which is that the phosphate groups are used to phosphorylate proteins. Not just enzymes, but enzymes are good examples of this. An enzyme can be either activated or deactivated. Certain enzymes can. A lot of enzymes work this way. By being phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. So this is a much more efficient way than saying, okay, I don't want this enzyme to work anymore, I'm going to destroy it. Because if you do destroy it, yes, it'll stop the reaction, but the next moment you might need to turn it back on. And if it's destroyed, you're going to have to go back, read the gene, transcribe it into messenger RNA, then expensively build, well, it's expensive to build the mRNA, then you have to spend more energy to actually translate it into a new version of the enzyme. It also takes time, so it's much more efficient if you can just temporarily turn the enzyme off or on. And phosphorylation is just one way that that happens. We'll be talking about a couple more in a second. First, though, in 17, we see more graphs. And the only difference between these top and bottom graphs are the x-axis. So it's rate of reaction, how well the enzyme is doing its job, in other words, because the greater the rate of reaction, the more it's sped up. So rate of reaction versus temperature on the top, rate of reaction versus pH on the bottom. pH and temperature, as I've said before, are two environmental variables that can drastically affect the shape of proteins in general. I mentioned this when we talked about acid precipitation back in that chapter, right? The sick-looking forest was so sick-looking because of acid rain, acid rain has too low a pH for enzymes to have their proper shape. Well, temperature is another variable that can drastically change the shape of proteins, including enzymes. And shape is everything because the specific shape, the specific function of a protein in general is determined by its shape. It's allowed because of its shape. Enzymes misshapen don't have the correct or a correct enough active site shape, and therefore they don't accept substrates as well. There is one shape that is best or optimal, and that's represented by the peak of the trace. Well, on the top one, we have two examples of enzymes that do the same job. So they're the same kind of enzyme. They're not identical molecules, but they do exactly the same job of catalyzing the same reaction, in other words. But in two different organisms, a human for black and a heat-tolerant or thermophilic bacterium for the red. These thermophilic bacteria not only survive temperatures, boiling water temperatures that would kill almost anything else, they actually thrive at those temperatures. They do better than lower temperatures. And what you see here is that if you get the temperature too low or too high compared to the optimum, then the rate of reaction goes down. That's because it's misshapen. Well, the human one, notice, is optimal right at about 38 degrees, which is average human body temperature. That's why this happened, by natural selection. What works best is what was favored. Whereas at 38, it's so low that the bacterial version of that same enzyme doesn't even work at all. It has to be near boiling point or closer to boiling point for it to work. And on the bottom, so the top one shows you that any given enzyme, not just these examples, has an optimum temperature. Also, though, as shown in the bottom, any given enzyme has an optimal pH. So once again, we have two enzymes that do the same job, but here they're both human enzymes in different places in the human. The stomach enzyme works very well at a pH a little under 2, which is very highly acidic, right? That makes sense because that's the environment in the stomach because of the hydrochloric acid that's produced by the lining of the stomach. So this is doing just its best right at the conditions in which it exists. Well, we call that stuff in the stomach, it's no longer food. It's only food until you eat it. Then it's chyme. That chyme doesn't stay in the stomach permanently, obviously. It goes on to the small intestine, which has a much more neutral pH, like the rest of the body, closer to 7, a little bit more. And so this enzyme that was working well in the stomach actually gets totally deactivated when it's introduced into the small intestine because of the pH change. But that's okay because a different version of the enzyme doing the same job is secreted by the epithelium that lines the small intestine. It has a much higher optimal pH, one that matches the surroundings. 18. Well, this is back to the issue of controlling enzymes, turning them on or off. Everything we've been talking about up to this point, as far as enzymes are concerned, is described by normal binding in this figure, meaning you have an enzyme with a specific active site that recognizes a specific substrate and therefore catalyzes a specific reaction. And if the substrate is around, if it's there and the enzyme is there, the substrate will bind to the enzyme, forming what is called the enzyme-substrate complex. That allows for lowering of the activation energy, and the substrate turns into product and gets released. That's everything we've been talking about. But in the middle, we have something new called competitive inhibition. So linguistically, think about this. Inhibition refers to inhibiting something, meaning turning it down at least, if not off. This is a way of controlling an enzyme. Enzymes can be turned on or turned off. Inhibition is turning off of an enzyme. And since the reactions go so slow without the help of an enzyme, when an enzyme is inhibited, you're not just turning the enzyme off, you're turning off the reaction. because it'll happen so slow that it's effectively off. Okay, so this is the way biochemical pathways are controlled, by controlling enzymes. But competitive inhibition is just one type of inhibition, and it's the situation in which some non-substrate, the inhibitor itself, this blue thing in the cartoon, it's a particle that's not a substrate, but it's shaped enough like the substrate that it can fit into the active site instead of the substrate fitting in there. It's like a different version of a key that still fits into a lock. All right? Well, this is why it's called competitive inhibition. These two particles, the normal substrate and the inhibitor, are both competing for the same place on the protein, the enzyme. They're both competing for the active site. The competitive inhibitor is not a substrate, so it doesn't get turned into anything when it binds to the active site. It simply blocks that active site, so even if there is substrate around, it's not going to bind, be able to bind, and therefore this particular enzyme, remember there's never just one copy of an enzyme, there are thousands or millions, but this one for the moment is turned off. Because if the substrate can't get into the active site, it's like this enzyme isn't even present. It's not going to do anything for the moment. And for as long as that inhibitor is bound to the active site on that enzyme. That's competitive inhibition. But there is also, as you see in C, a thing called non-competitive inhibition. It still involves an inhibitor, which is some sort of particle, acting as a switch, more or less. But it's non-competitive if the inhibitor binds to the enzyme somewhere other than the active site. Notice the inhibitor in this, the orange one or salmon-colored one, is binding anywhere else other than the active site. Why does that shut the enzyme down? The active site is still open. What does? Not really. I mean, it's still exactly the same protein. But what is different about it? What do we say almost every day, including today earlier? When a ligand, which an inhibitor is, binds to a protein, which an enzyme is, finish the sentence. There is a conformational change of the protein, which is the enzyme in this case. So they didn't particularly draw this well because it looks like there's still a pretty good shape fit. It's not as perfect as it could be, though. What I'm saying here, though, is even though the inhibitor is binding somewhere other than the active site is still part of the enzyme, and when the enzyme changes shape, the active site gets deformed. So it's open, yes, but it doesn't have the right shape at the moment, in this deformed state, and so the substrate can't go in there and bind. So it's just as much turned off for the moment as a competitive inhibitor has turned off the other enzyme. Okay, now that's the difference between competitive and non-competitive inhibition. Inhibition is turning off an enzyme, but there it's also possible for an enzyme that is normally in its unbound state, before anything binds to it, normally off. These ones are normally on and they can get turned off. You could also have one that has to be turned on by something binding to it. That would require the opposite of inhibition, which is activation. All right. But while we're still looking at this cartoon, I want you to make sense in your mind that there's not going to be any such thing as competitive activation, right? That wouldn't make sense. Do you see why? Why can't you have competitive activation? No. What makes it competitive? Yeah, they're both trying to get into the active site. Well, how's that ever going to activate an enzyme? It's always going to block the active site if it's competitive, right? That can only turn it off. That's what I meant. Is that clear? On the other hand, non-competitive control can be either inhibitory or activational. It can inhibit or activate the enzyme. It can go in either direction. And another name for non-competitive control is allosteric regulation. Allosteric regulation refers to some regulatory particle, either an inhibitor or an activator, binding to the enzyme somewhere other than the active site. We see a picture of that in 19. This is an enzyme, but it's really four enzymes in one, because this is a multimeric protein, first of all, right? It has quaternary structure because it's made out of four, in this case, four polypeptides, each of which is identical to the other three. It's only one type of polypeptide, but there are four of them. Each has its own active site. So it's really four enzymes in one. It can process four substrates simultaneously. But notice the double arrows here listed as oscillation. When it's not bound to anything, this complex enzyme goes back and forth between these two shapes. And notice that the active sites drastically change their shape. It goes back and forth many times a second, simply because the G values of these two are very close to each other. So it just keeps bouncing back and forth because neither one is particularly more stable than the other. But only one of them is appropriately shaped to receive substrates. That's why it's called the active form. The other one's inactive. Okay. The green one is an allosteric regulator that is acting to activate this enzyme. So it's an allosteric activator. And notice it's allosteric because it's binding somewhere other than the active sites. But when it binds, it locks the enzyme into this active shape. It's no longer going to oscillate between active and inactive. It's going to stay as active, and therefore any substrates that are present will be able to bind to the active sites. Keeps it on, in other words. It activates it. This red thing, though, is an allosteric inhibitor. Binds to a different position on it, which locks it into the inactive form. That keeps it off for as long as that activator or inhibitor is bound. It's not permanent. Either of these two types of allosteric regulators can unbind and therefore allow this enzyme to go into the other form. That brings up 20, which uses a real example. Not all the details are shown, but the detail doesn't matter anyway. I'll just mention, though, that in this pathway, you start out with the initial substrate being threonine. That's what the cell has originally. It goes through steps, in this case five reactions in the pathway, each catalyzed by its own enzyme, until it finally turns what was originally threonine stepwise into isoleucine. Isoleucine is the final product, in other words. And that example doesn't really matter at all. It's just a specific example. It could be anything turning into anything else via a pathway. But the main point here is that the cell can use what is called feedback inhibition, which is a type of negative feedback, to control this pathway. We talked about feedback mechanisms, it seems like a long time ago now. And remember that there are two major categories of feedback, positive and negative, but by far the more prevalent is negative feedback, because that's the only type of feedback that can lead to homeostasis, right? It makes the error smaller, negative feedback does. It tries to negate the error, and that brings the variable, whatever it is, closer to set point. But you can talk about errors here as well. The error here is an improper amount of isoleucine. Before we get to the part of there being an error, though, let's just say that the cell, at the moment, needs isoleucine. If it has threonine and all these enzymes are working properly, then it can make isoleucine by running this pathway. So, as long as the cell needs the final product, it is appropriate to run this pathway. Okay? And keep it running for as long as the cell needs the isoleucine. But eventually the cell is going to have enough isoleucine if you continue to make more. And that's when an error would show up, right? In this case, the error would be too much isoleucine is being made. Well, that's where feedback inhibition automatically comes into play. Because isoleucine itself is acting as an allosteric inhibitor. Right? If the cell continues to use isoleucine for whatever it needs it for, it's not going to build up. It's not going to be present. It's going to be used by the cell continuously, right? But the moment it starts building up because the cell already has enough, then it's going to be a particle that's in solution and therefore able to act as an allosteric inhibitor. Isoleucine itself can, this is why it's called feedback, it feeds back to an earlier part of the process. Isoleucine itself allosterically binds to a place right here on enzyme 1, changing the shape of it such that the active site is now deformed and threonine can no longer bind to enzyme 1. So it turns off step 1 of, in this case, the 5-step pathway. Well, it doesn't matter which of these steps you turn off, right? You turn off enzyme 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, you're still going to turn off further production of isoleucine, which is appropriate, right? That's reducing the error by not continuing to produce isoleucine. Any one of the steps would have worked, but in most cases, it is the first or a very early step in the pathway. Why does it make sense to turn it off at enzyme 1 versus the others?
You'd have some weird byproduct.
Right. Well, not so much weird as just unneeded. If you turn it off at step 5, enzyme 5, the cell is still going to go through with making all these intermediates, which it doesn't need because their only use is to eventually make isoleucine, and you're shutting that off. So if you shut it off up here, you save energy, you save time, you just save waste. Does that make sense? Okay, now, this error is going to be reduced. Right now, you just keep the error from getting any worse by shutting down the pathway, right? But the error will be reduced by the fact that this stockpile of isoleucine that's been built up will eventually be used by the cell again. And the more the isoleucine stockpile gets used by the cell, the more scarce it becomes in the environment, and therefore the more likely that it will diffuse away from this enzyme, no longer binding to it, and therefore the enzyme will automatically resume its original shape with an open active site, and therefore the pathway will automatically turn back on right when it's needed again, and isoleucine production will continue. So the cell doesn't have to think about this, it just happens automatically by feedback inhibition. Any questions on that? All right, then let's transition to the next chapter.